in the Fat Wallet Show this week, where budgets fail. Hi, I'm Christia. With me, as always, Simon Brown. How's it going?
It's very excellent.
It's excellent with me also. If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that we a bleat version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to presidential candidate Sean Combrink for making that happen.
Hey. Why? Because he's tall.
Yes. This Thursday evening, we have a power hour at the JSE. It's our first one of the year. They are free events. They are literally at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, where they let just anyone in, apparently, because they let just us in. We do this one every year. We talk about tax-free accounts, what they are, how they work, what you should buy, what we are buying, et cetera, et cetera. It's always super fun. So that's this Thursday. You know, this date, this Thursday, is 2022-2020.
Because you've told me that already. That's about the fourth date you've pointed out to me this year.
It's already so crazy. I love it. It feels very freaky. By the way, if you guys have kids, you can bring them to these events. Like, I notice a lot of the time we have dads who come without children and without spouses, because presumably mom is at home taking care of the kids. You can bring your children. We'll find a little spot for you guys to sit.
No, we can do kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's I mean, the
twist, they make a noise and I just talk loud.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we're having a fire afterwards.
Yes. So afterwards, we're doing a little meetup of the Fat Wallet community members. So if you're in the Joburg area, you want to hang out with us and talk about financial independence and nerd out a little bit, we're going to be going to Sandton Central afterwards. And what's it called?
24 Central.
24 Central, sorry. 24 Central afterwards, which is just next door to the JSE. And, you know, grabbing a drink and talking about financial independence. It's going to be lovely and nerdy. Our price-weighted index is getting just hammered so hard. It is so embarrassing. We are 5.49% down since August. Mm-hmm. In that same period, the Satrix 40 is up 5.28%. So it is just, it is looking so, so bleak. And I'm seeing here that City Lodge is a very big part of this problem. And I don't know why. So City Lodge and Telkom, the two of them.
Turns out no one went on holiday over Christmas.
You know, that's really true. I noticed that. Joburg was so busy.
I can't remember where I was. I was in Durban and then Northern Kruger.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, you didn't stay at the City Lodge either time. And now look where we are.
And now look.
It's a disaster.
Hey, City Lodge is not the problem in this little problem index. there are two problems. One, excuse me, is Telkom. And two, is that price weighted is a terrible idea.
Well, it's starting to...
And I told you that.
It's starting to seem that way. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm starting to... Like, even the Zak 1 Lap Index is beating us. He's down 2.97%.
So how's the love? Because purple's come back a bit.
No, I don't look at the love index anymore. It just makes me... It's too embarrassing. I can't. All right. So our friends at VeriCred very kindly made the legal advisor Hugo available to us to look into... Do you remember Keith wrote us to say... When you get vehicle financing, it's not legal according to the National Credit
Yes,
Act
yes.
to add the interest at the beginning of the period mm-hmm. and then force you to pay all of it so that there's mm-hmm. no benefit to settling early. So then I asked the guys at VeriCred, so they made that... anyway, so VeriCred helped us to do that date series that's available on justonelap.com. It's like the best content we've ever done on date. So if you're struggling to get out of date, you have to go there to go look at that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so Hugo was saying that Keith was right. It is actually not legal. So according to the National Credit Act, you can settle at any time and you're only liable for the interest accrued to your settlement date. So on credit agreements over 1 million rand, though, things get more complicated. So that's a home loan and stuff. They, according to the National Credit Act, there can be a penalty there.
So the banks, if you exit your home loan early, charge you.
Yeah.
Or they want 90 days notice.
So what Hugo says is when you get vehicle financing, before you sign the dotted line, you have to ask the financier whether there are any settlement penalties and how that's legal. Because he's saying... Obviously, big institutions like banks and stuff wouldn't do anything that is illegal according to the National Credit Act. They've got legal teams to look into all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make very sure before you sign the dotted line that there's no penalty in case your credit comes from somewhere else.
Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha. Okay.
Thank you to VeryCred for making poor Hugo shame. He was so nice. All right. Our win of the week this week is Ken. He's from the Fat Wallet Community Group on Facebook. He made such an excellent post. So he says, I've looked for a post on the Satrix World plus Satrix Emerging Market as an investment versus the Ashburton 1200 in various places, including this group, but he couldn't find one. We haven't done one. He says, in episode 85 of the Fat Wallet Show, the Ashburton 1200 was voted by Chris and Simon as the one ETF to rule them all. Stealthy Wealth, on the other hand, voted for the Satrix World as the one ETF to rule them all.
Mm-hmm.
The argument for the Satrix 1200 is more diversification and emerging markets. The argument for the Satrix World is lower fees. So does Satrix World plus Satrix Emerging Market give the best of both? The argument against the Satrix Emerging Market could be too much Tencent exposure, but in episode 72, Simon did some math and determined that there was less Tencent than in the JSE Top 40 index, so that seems okay. Also, just remember, guys, ETFs and indices change all the time, right? It, according to what the market is doing. Whoops. I just killed my cat. According to what the market is doing. So when, like, episode 72 came out about 2 years ago, I would assume. So that might have changed. So you need to go and look at those minimum disclosure documents every time before you make a decision. Don't just go on the maths we did long ago.
Yeah, I mean, I'm having a quick check on the MSCI Developed Markets Index and Tencent's not even a top 10.
So he says, does it cost more to hold two ETFs than it does to hold one? Satrix World has a TER of 0.35%. Satrix Emerging Market has a TER of 0.4%. So he says, for the sake of simplicity, I'll assume that they both have a TER of 0.4% and 100 Rand is brought in a 50-50 ratio. So in other words, if it's 0.4% for one and he buys 50 Rand and it's 0.4% for the other and he buys 50 Rand, then it's still 0.4% for the full 100 Rand,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So he says the Ashburton 1200 has a TER of 0.6%. Does this mean that the combined cost of the Satrix World plus the Satrix Emerging Market is less than the Ashburton 1200?
Yes.
Yes, it does. So he says, I presume there would be a cost of an additional trade, so two trades versus one. But that's also not true because...
Well, not applicable if your broker doesn't do minimums or if your trade size is above the minimum.
Because it's a percentage of the total amount, so, and not a percentage per transaction.
At Standard Bank, it's on their normal equity, it's a percentage, 0.5 or 110, whichever is greater. So if I'm doing a 22,000 Rand trade, then it's 0.5. But if I'm doing a 10,000 Rand trade, it's 110. So assuming there are no minimums, or assuming that you are doing off big enough that the minimum falls away, then it makes no odds.
Yeah. So if you pay, just think about it. You have to think about it in the same way that you thought about the TERs, Ken. So it works the same. It's going to work the same way. You're going to pay 0.25% on 50 Rand, and then you're going to pay 0.25% on the other 50 Rand, right?
Yeah.
He says, using Easy Equities to purchase the ETFs, would buying both still work out cheaper than the Ashburton 1200 after considering both transaction cost and TER? Yes,
yeah,
they would. So now he has a question. He says, if you do this, if you do Satrix World plus Satrix Emerging Markets, how much emerging market, because obviously a 50-50 ratio is not great, because that's a lot of volatility, depending on what you want for your portfolio, I'm assuming. So how much Satrix World and how much emerging market do you buy?
I mean, the first thing we have to now also assume is that this is a standalone investment, because, of course, if you look through and you've got a retirement annuity, et cetera, you've got 75% exposed to South Africa. Of course, of that 75%, 60% is not, and that then leaves you...
that makes it really complicated.
It leaves you with 30% probably exposed to South Africa, and we are an emerging market. So you've already got EM exposure, although you've got very concentrated EM exposure. But let's ignore that for the moment. How much emerging market exposure do you want? Probably 10 to 20% at max.
Yeah, that's already quite heavy.
Yeah, so 10.
So the Ashburton 1200 has 7%.
Yeah, and that's why I started at 10. Ditto with the Global Dividend Aristocrats from Core.
Yes.
So that's why I say a base of around 10. You might even want to drop it as low as 5.
So interestingly, the S&P 500, which I learned last week at the S&P Dow Jones conference, the S&P 500, 4% of the earnings of that index comes from Africa.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know.
It's more than I thought.
Yeah, it's a lot more than I thought.
Well, we buy a lot of iPhones and Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola.
And toothpaste.
Yeah, so I wouldn't go, like 5% is a good amount if you want to do it the way that the Ashburton 1200 does it, do 7% if you wanted to. I wouldn't go more than 10% because that's a lot.
That developed market ETF already has emerging market in it because, again, the companies within that ETF, although they might be developed market companies such as Apple and Microsoft, are making money in emerging markets.
That's true. And also, don't forget about your RA, because that makes a big... So the thing is, basically, Ken, what I'm saying is, we are right, but Stealthy is also right.
Yeah.
So if it's like, when you look purely at the performance of the ETF, when developed markets struggle and emerging markets do well, the Ashburton 1200 would do a little bit better. However, if you're buying the Satrix World, especially if you have a Regulation 28 compliant product like a retirement annuity or a pension fund, you already have emerging market exposure. So it's about like, are you looking at this specific product or are you looking at your portfolio as a whole?
So here's a fun factoid. I'm looking at the MSCI World Index in US dollars since Jan of 05, so 15 years, because this is a January 31 update. They've basically done exactly the same, emerging versus developed. If I look at them over since inception in 87, the world has done 8%, the emerging market done 10.5%. But over the last 10 years, world has beaten emerging market every period.
Mm. Well, I mean, that makes sense because we have had a nice little rally. All right. This was a really good... I love the way you think about this. I thought that Ken deserved to be the win of the week this week just because he'd obviously spent a lot of time thinking this through. And this is a really good way to think about your portfolio. Yeah, like, this is a good amount of engagement.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys are new to this podcast and you are, like, freaking out right now, don't worry.
None of it made sense.
You'll pick it up eventually. Don't worry about it. All right. So let's talk a little bit about budgets today.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking budgets because it's tax year. And this is a good time, like the end of the tax year is always a good time to sit back and reflect on whether you're doing the right things in your personal finances. And I'm saying that because of tax rebates and tax-free savings accounts. So last week for the ETF blog on justonelap.com, I wrote about all of the tax that you would pay when you're not invested in a tax-free savings account. If you buy an ETF outside of a tax-free savings account, it's worthwhile paying attention to that stuff because in the long run, it makes a big difference to the amount of money that you get back. For the same reason, kind of, that fees make a big difference to the amount of money.
Tax is a fee.
Yeah. So you have to deduct the tax from your returns to get to actually what you really are getting out. And we don't often account for that because tax rates are so individual that it's really difficult to say, all right, this is exactly what your returns would be after your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worthwhile to go look at that. So I want to talk about budgets and what are they good for and where they fall short and how we account for tax and tax rebates and whether we should account for tax rebates in our budgets. So if you're looking a year ahead at your budget and you're like, all right, this is going to be my budget, should you also take into account whether or not you're going to get back a tax rebate? And then I want to talk about doing line items like budgeting for every single thing versus having a big pool of money. And then maybe alternatives to budgets. Because the thing is, like, when you read about personal finance, it's actually so... tired, you know, you always hear people say, oh, you have to start with a budget. But sometimes I don't know.
No, I mean, you at some point you have to do the budget. You might not have to start with the budget.
What do you think you have to start with?
Well, I mean, you could start with something else. If you've got a pile of debt and you're clearing off the debt instead of doing a budget, you're doing something good. As long as you're doing something that's moving your finances forward, like maybe paying off debt aggressively, like maybe saving or something. I mean, as long as you're doing something good around your money, that's better than doing nothing.
So do you think...
I do think a budget should be first, but absent of.
Do you think that a debt repayment plan, if you're just starting, is kind of like a sort of budget?
It is a sort of budget. The risk is that... So what a budget gives is structure. So you start a debt repayment plan, and then one day your debt's gone, and what's happened is instead... Let's say you're paying 1,000 rand a month on debt, and then one day it's gone. But that 1,000 rand a month has now just bled its way into your budget, and you can't see it. You don't have 1,000 rand at the end of the month left to spend over because there was no structure to the process.
So what I do personally is I have a list of fixed expenses that I know goes out every month. That, all right, let me say what I used to do and what I do now, because this is important, because I have made every single mistake available to make in finances. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm a good example. So when I was repaying my debt, I focused only on repaying my debt. I didn't even, like, I was like, I know I have these expenses, these fixed expenses that I have to pay, like rent and stuff, but the rest of the stuff was just money for debt. Yeah. And I didn't have any discretionary spending because I was so desperate to get out of debt that I put everything into my debt.
Yeah.
So that wasn't really, and that wasn't a fixed thing. It was just me deciding internally, cool, this is what I'm going to do now. Mm-hmm. As I started paying off my debt, as you just said, I started noticing more and more money available to me mm-hmm. every month. And then I was like, cool, I am now in charge of my finances. And so I drew up the most complicated budget known to man. Like 64.50 will go to, my tire budget every month. And then even though you don't put tires on your car every month, I was like, this is the amount of money that goes towards tires every month and mm-hmm. stuff. And I really just overcompensated. I went way too detailed. And it didn't get overwhelming. I just started doing so much mental accounting. So I'd be like, oh, well, I'm 60 Rand short. I might as well take from my tire budget this month and whatever. And I did that for the longest time until I read Sam's book, Manage Your Money Like a Grown Up.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was saying, well, money is money. You know, like when you earmark 64.50 for your tire budget every month, it doesn't do anything different than the other money just sitting there. It's just money, right? And it can go where it goes. Mm-hmm. And that, like, understanding that for the first time, which seemed very obvious, but it took me a while because I'm apparently not very smart. Then when I realized that, then the whole thing became a lot easier. And now what I do is I have a budget of fixed expenses every month. And the reason why I have that is because it helps me with my savings. So I don't do it for the spending. I do it for the saving because I want to make sure that I'm saving as much as possible. So I'm like, okay, if these are my fixed expenses and this is the savings ratio that I'm targeting, how much money do I have left at the end?
So you almost come back to it. Yeah.
So that's what I do now. What do you do?
So, I mean, I have a formal budget, but it's fairly, it's broad. So there's all the fixed expenses, of course, that go off. And those are my primary expenses that I have, the biggest expenses. So fixed expenses and monthly savings. So those all go off. And then there's categories. So like there's car. And car includes, petrol and insurance and stuff like that. The ad hocs, for example, the car service needing tires and stuff, that then comes out of my emergency fund. And what I do is I have a component of my budget, which is sundry. So I then replug that emergency fund, etc. So there's a lot of...
You know, there's a girl named Sandri listening to the show going, yes.
Hello.
It's my money.
and that sort of pointy area down there is actually a little bit messy. What I should have is sundry, and that should cover the tires, but sometimes it doesn't. So then I pull out of emergency, and then any sundry which isn't moved then gets moved into emergency. So I know it's messy.
So I was,
but then I do broad categories as well. So like there's food and there's entertainment, and entertainment includes, wine and going to Midmar and all of that sort of thing as well.
So I was speaking to Warren Ingram the other day, and he was saying what you should, or maybe I was listening to him because he also has a podcast now. But what he was saying is that you should have, if there's a service once a year for your car and you know more or less how much it costs, mm-hmm. you should put that money away for the service every month.
Yeah, and then bulk it up and...
But I don't do that anymore. I do what you do now. So I have my fixed expenses and my savings, and those go out. And then I'm left with X amount of money, and that money goes wherever that money goes. So if I want to put petrol in with that money, I do that. If I want to drink it all, I do that. And sometimes I do that. If I want to buy gifts, I do that. So, and it just, it makes it a bit easier. But then when there is something over and above that is unusual, like a car service or whatever, that comes out of my emergency fund.
Yeah. And what I don't do, so although I've got a bucket for, you know, running the vehicle, and I've got a bucket for food, and I've got a bucket for entertainment and drink and the like, it all just sits in my account and I spend it. And as long as I don't overrun at the end of the month, it's no problem. But my income then fluctuates. You know, then I write an article for someone and they pay me and money comes in and I don't see it and it gets spent or something.
Oh,
but I don't stress. So if you said to me, how much do I spend on whiskey? I don't know. I know what I budget for it broadly, but I don't know what I spend on it every month.
Mm. That's really interesting because, you know, it's good to know where your money goes. And I have to say, I love using 22/7 for this instead of the budget, because then you really have it. You see very clearly where your money goes, and it's horrific sometimes to see for me, it's horrific to see what I spend money on. But you know what I also did? So Patrick and Stealthy were talking about how it works when you move your entire salary into your home loan, then you use your credit card and then blah, blah, blah. That whole system failed me so badly because when I have money in my account, I can see the money leaving my account and I'm like, cool, now I've spent all my money. When you go for the credit card, you go in the other direction. Mm-hmm. So you go, like, oh, okay, well, I've still got X amount of credit.
Carry on going until one day you can't.
Yeah, exactly. And I did that for a few months and I realized that actually I've been overspending a lot doing it that way. So I've been overspending more than the interest I would be saving on my home loan. So I've cut that out because I feel like just apparently my personality just doesn't work like that.
So what I do is every month I pay the credit card, so that goes to zero. But I've got an overdraft on my current account, and I actually have no idea how much that overdraft is. And what I do is at the end of every month, if there's anything left, so and I get paid weirdly, so on the first of every month, well, the last day, 31st, 29th, whatever it is, any money that's left, I sweep into my emergency money. And if I'm in a negative position, I sweep out of my emergency to take myself back to zero.
Yeah. I also settle everything that I can every month. So the reason why I wanted to talk about this is I think when we – maybe because it's such a concrete thing that everybody tells you you should do. Like, you should do – like, you can't manage your money if you don't have a budget. I think that's – I think it's very possible to – manage your money well without having a budget. I think that budgets look different. Like everybody is, because the thing is, here's a budget, right? Money in versus money out.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a budget tells you. This is the amount of money that you have coming in. This is the amount of money that's going out. And this is the amount of money, hopefully, if everything goes well, that's left over or that you're short. And that's what a budget tells you. And that's not, I'm not saying it's not important to know that. It really is important to know that. But you can know that in various ways without...
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time when I was in debt, what I would do is I would sit and draw up a budget and feel that because I drew up a budget, I've now done something. And like to
sit
there...
You have, but unless you actively...
To sit there and look at numbers on a page is not the same as implementing some sort of action that makes your finances better. So if you're, you know, if this is you... You should know that your budget is an avoidance tactic that you're using to get away from actually managing your money. That's why I really love the spending ratio and the saving ratio. I feel like that's a much better indication of whether you're better off this month than you were the month before.
Yeah, it's a nice quick sort of test.
Yeah. So if you look at those two ratios, then you can go, all right, my spending ratio has gone down. In other words, I'm spending less and my saving ratio has gone up. In other words, I'm saving less. And that's a really good indicator of whether you're getting ahead or not.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really cool about that is that your saving ratio also includes debt repayments.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing better just by repaying more debts, you can see every month that you are better off than the month before.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can sit there and lie to yourself with your budget. And trust me, I have done this, I know how easy it is.
No, the easiest thing in the world to lie about and of no use, but happens a lot, I suspect.
Yeah, and the thing with money is, it's not the lies. Like, very few people lie to other people about their money. It's the lies that we tell ourselves about our money that's really keeping us stuck.
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about tax and tax rebates and whether we should include those in our budgets.
So there's two things. Well, I mean, you can or you can't. Your tax, you've got no control of it. It stays the same twice a year. It changes once when Pravin Gordhan, Tito Mboweni does the budget.
It's okay. That's it. Easy mistake.
And another time when you get a salary increase, assuming you get a salary increase. Apparently that happens out there in the world for some people. Yeah, I know, cute, isn't it? So I don't even worry. You know, I manage tax because I've got variable amounts of money coming in and they, you know, I'm saving a set percentage every month and that just automatically zips off. But to an average person who's got a job, who's earning, you know, gets 12 or 13 paychecks a month, their tax is going to be fixed. It'll change twice a year. Once it'll go up and eat in when, and the 1st of April, when the new treasury budget kicks in, you might pay a little bit more tax, so you have less money. And then at some point when you get your salary increase, you'll get more money, but then you'll pay a little more tax, so you'll get less more money than you had thought you would get. Yeah, I know. In terms of rebate, I mean, you can structure it so that you don't get rebate. You're paying RAs and stuff, you can request that your company rebates that for you already. But if you're getting a rebate, my sense is that it shouldn't, I mean, maybe it's, that rebate should then be targeted for something. And that something it should be targeted should either be save it, school fees, you know, something like a big expense that lurks out somewhere. And that can then take pressure off the budget for the rest of the year or a period of time.
I really love the idea of asking your employer to rebate it as you go along, because that money, tax rebates tends to feel like free money very easily, and we spend it and spend it over and over again before we get it.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be a good idea to do that, but even so, you will probably get some sort of rebate. Just first of all, because all of us get a little rebate from the government, firstly, and secondly, medical aid and all of that stuff also gets deducted if your employer doesn't pay for it. But I love the idea of just working that rebate into your salary already. I think that that's a, it makes it easier just in terms of mental accounting, I guess. In terms of alternatives to budgets, the saving ratio and the spending ratio, that really is something to look at every month. So even if you don't budget anything, you can just go Google how to what these ratios are. They're very easy to work out. You can do them easily. So basically, it's your salary, the amount you save deducted divided by your salary, and the amount you spend divided by your salary. And that's how you get to that ratio. And what you want to do is you want to shrink the one and grow the other one. That's a really good alternative to a budget. For me, looking back at what I spent is a lot more helpful than looking forward, because it shows me all of my patterns. And if you use something like 22-7, speaking of tax, I find that that's a really good way when you do your tax returns and stuff to just get that data as well.
Yeah.
So I know exactly how much I spent in petrol between Feb 2018 and Feb 2019 because of that tool. It's really awesome.
So I don't use 22-7 much, but I then do use it for that once a year at the end of the year, just like, yeah, you know, where has money gone? What did I intend? Because also, I mean, like, petrol's a moving target, right? It's one price one month, the other price another month. You drive more, you drive less, etc. Just to give me a sense of, okay, this is what I thought I was going to spend. What did I spend?
So it was really interesting for me in the petrol thing. I fill up my tank. So I drive 500 Ks and then I fill it up and then I drive 500. So I know that every time I put in a full tank of petrol, I've driven 500 Ks, which made it really easy for me to calculate how many kilometers I drove that year, which I wouldn't have known otherwise because I don't keep track of stuff like that. So that's like a, but I feel like that tool is a lot more useful to me than a budget.
Yeah.
And the 22-7 budgeting tool, I also don't love.
I've never even looked at it.
It's cool in a way because they say typically, so you can default it where they say typically you spend X amount of money on gifts every month, and that's therefore your gift budget, which is nice because they do a lot of that more detailed stuff that I don't do in my fixed expenses budget. It's nice to see, okay, typically I spend about $200 a month on presents or whatever.
Okay, seems a lot.
But So that's, it's useful in that sense, but again, like a very itemized budget, I just feel it doesn't really work.
The problem with 22/7 that I keep on running into is buy stuff at Woolies. Now, was that liquor? Was that food? Was that gift?
Oh, but I manage that. You know, it's really cool. So this, okay, this is again, this is not paid for content. I just use it and I like it. What's really cool is you can split transactions.
Mm.
So I noticed I was still paying rent and electricity, and I would make one payment over to the managing agent. And then I would go into 22/7 and split it and say, all right, that was my rent and this was my electricity. So I have a really good sense of where my money goes because I do that. I do those splits. So sometimes I draw money at Pick and Pay, for example, but I also buy groceries. And then when I get home in 22/7, I go split it and say, okay, this was cash and that was groceries. Yeah, it works super well.
I don't do that.
And then you
seems like hard work.
And then you export CSV files and it works so lucky. I love
the CSV files. Yeah, those I do.
Oh, so awesome.
Yeah, and then I dump them into Excel and send them to an accountant.
I know. That's so great. It's like, please fix. It's wonderful. Do you want to say anything else about budgets?
No, two last things. A budget is a family thing. In other words, you can't do a budget on your own. You've got to involve your partner.
Good point.
And if you've got kids, involve the kids. I mean, I don't care if they're 2 years old. Kids need to be involved as well, because budgets, you know, they put they can put a cramp on a lifestyle, and the kid needs to realize why. So it's critical that it's an entire family process.
It's such a good way to just bring everything out in the open.
Yeah,
it's
great. And I said with my niece and nephew, who I saw what would have been last weekend with their mother, and so it's February, so it's tough because, you know, January and school and all of that sort of stuff and et cetera, et cetera. And they had to pay to go watch me swim Midmar and everything else. So they, you know, when they want something and my sister's like, it's like not in the budget, like, you know the budget as well as I know the budget. And they're both like, oh, that's not fair. And off they go. Like, yeah. There's no, you know, it's just, I mean, they the budget rules supreme. Mm-hmm. And the way they manage their pocket money and that sort of thing. So it's day 9 and 11. And they've been doing money with my sister since day one.
So how far into a relationship do you think you have this conversation?
I'm not the person to ask this.
Because you don't have this. You've been married for like 30 years and you don't have this.
My wife still doesn't talk about money with me. I don't know. Because when you were saying earlier, like, so my wife doesn't have a credit card. So she has my credit card, right? So it's a credit card in her name, but it's on my account. So 22/7 picks that all up for me. My question is, so a couple and they've both got separate bank accounts and credit cards, how do you manage that budget thing?
Look, I assume when you start living together, like you can't leave it beyond.
So you can't avoid
because you share lifestyle expenses and stuff.
Yes, yes.
But even like it's a tricky thing to manage. Oh, speaking of managing money with other people, split-wise, if you are in a relationship or if you go out with the same group of friends a lot and you guys tend to share expenses and stuff, Split-wise is an awesome, awesome app to do that. I love that app. I think it's great.
Ha, cool. And the other thing I would say is that budgets in of themselves are not half as scary as they seem to seem. The schlep of doing a budget I really love, because hey, numbers, Excel spreadsheets.
I know, it's so theoretical.
It's fun. What is scary about a budget is that suddenly you realize that A, you're spending more than you earn, and B, that you're mostly spending it on. Mm. And that's a wake up call. But
the thing is, again, this is not a budget. It's looking back. So because in your budget, you don't spend more than you earn. In your budget, you spend exactly the right amount. It's only when you look back at last month's spending that you realize, actually, the thing is, like, your budget standing alone without looking back at your spending is useless, actually. Like, you have to, maybe it's worthwhile, if you have a budget, look at last month's expenses and go and write them down and compare what you budgeted.
So that's where you would start, right? If you've never done a budget before, the first thing you do is look at last month and you realize that you earned 20 and spent 22. And you're like, well, that's why my credit card's out of control. So, I mean, it's not going to be fun the first time, but, like, you know what? Suck it up.
Yeah.
Probably the wrong advice, but I mean, short answer is you got to do it.
Yeah. Look, the thing is, your goal, your first financial goal, your only financial goal should be to be better off next month than you are this month, right? And that's, you don't need to draw up a budget to do that. You don't need to do, you know, like that should be your goal.
Yeah, look, you can get away with not, I mean, I've spent years and I use the argument that I do the budget in my head and stuff like that. I've spent years without budgets and I'm still alive.
Yeah. Yeah, it really worries me that when you look at so-called financial education, that this is always where people start. And so, I suppose it's
this, how to apply for credit and how to balance a checkbook.
Yeah.
Who has checkbooks?
Why should they balance? Why aren't they better designed? All right. Do you want to say anything else?
Nope, that's me.
All right.
Promise, so, promise.
Mariette has some feedback on her private banker. And I'm afraid it's not good news for a private banker. She says, I've had a private banker for a few years now, and there are stupid things that they do for me, which I can live without. They do help a lot with emails getting lost in the big ship. There have been a few times where I've requested session documents, interest rate adjustments, etc., where it would take very long to sort out. But if I put my private banker on the matter, it is sorted within a day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm busy moving my tax-free shares account over to Easy Equities and I'm battling. And this is where the private banker will come in very handy. I'm soon not going to have one anymore. I'm downgrading my account to save on fees. But it is slightly ironic that I need this paid service when I want to invest better.
Yeah, the short answer is that, I mean, the... You know, the few times I use my private banker, she's awesome. But is it worth bang for buck? No. But the thing that scares me more than monsters under the bed and dark stormy nights is bureaucracy, and particularly banking bureaucracy.
Listen, you guys, if you are about to graduate or you have just graduated with any sort of BSc degree, medical degree, engineering, etc., etc., there is a bank in this world who comes to you guys and promises you a fancy, oh, I'm a professional bank account. They are stealing your fucking money. Stop doing that. They're charging you like $600 a month for the privilege of saying that you have a degree. You know what? Mm. You have a degree. If you want people to know that, show them your degree.
Yeah, so make a photocopy and stick it to your forehead.
You don't need to show them your bank account. If you have that account, go and close it. It is a ripoff. I'm telling you now.
So private bankers are not worth...
the money. You know what? You know who I do think is worth the money? So we've got a company who writes a family wealth blog for us.
Mm.
And what they do is they work with families who are worth over 100 million rand.
Mm-hmm.
And they help them manage everything. So they manage their estates, they manage their offshore investments, their tax planning, blah, 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 blah. And you pay a service for that fee. And you know what? That's worth it because you have 100 million rand and family dynamics. And they've got a psychologist on staff to help people deal with family dynamics around money when you're a high income family. That's a person you pay.
Yeah.
When you earn a normal salary, if you want to pay for a service, pay somebody to help you with your tax. That's always worth it because tax professionals are...
Hey, my private banker doesn't help me with tax.
Yeah, exactly. So tax is worth paying for. Solid financial advice that is paid by the hour is worth paying for.
Not coming from someone employed by a bank.
Yeah. Do not pay for bank accounts. It's dumb. It's like that era is over.
So
it's done now.
It's my mission for this year. Now that I no longer fly SAA, I no longer need my fancy credit card to get into lounge access because it won't work. So then suddenly all of those accounts are going to get closed. And I was thinking...
You're going to have so much money.
Yeah, I know. No, it's like... No, except that I still need to get into a lounge.
You don't.
Well, what do Yerkes do at the airport?
Just drink coffee at Mug and Bean and eat a giant muffin. I mean, harden the
fuck up. I don't like muffins,
you know?
And I don't like Mug and Bean coffee. but so with that process, so that's, I mean, it's like $3,000 a year. And that's like, okay. And then I'd like, oh, maybe I should get rid of my private banker. But truthfully, that does scare me. But maybe I should.
You know what? For $3,000 a year, you can pay an Uber Black to take you to the airport.
No, it's going to cost me more than $3,000 a year to get lounge access.
Stop going to the f***ing lounge, Simon. This is such an easy thing. I mean, get it together.
Okay, me and you travel different.
All right. Mariana has a question about savings. I'm so surprised that we've never gotten this question before, unless she did, or we did and I forgot. She's also an engineer, and she says her petrol consumption has actually improved since she discovered our show, because she drives really slowly to listen to the whole show in the car, which I think is fantastic. We help in so many ways. She says, what salary is referred to when people talk about a percentage of salary going to savings? Is it cost to company, which includes, in her case, her employer's contribution to pension and provident fund and medical aid and UIF? Is it gross salary, which is a cash salary excluding the employer's contributions? Or is it take-home salary, which excludes deductions, pension fund contribution, medical aid, UIF, and group insurance?
You choose. So I would choose the smallest number, so your percentage seems bigger, but you're comparing yourself against yourself. You're not comparing yourself against somebody else, against Pretorius or someone. So you're comparing yourself against yourself. So if your number was 20% this month and it's 23 next, you know where you are, whether you use cost to company. I mean, they're all real numbers. The take home, I mean, the one probably is the gross, because the take home is already got some deductions that are technically savings, pension, provident, retirement, whatever that might be.
The thing is, I think if you're working out, let's say, your 27.5% RA or pension contribution,
then that it's cost to company.
That's cost to company. So yeah, that's like the full package that you get. Remember, cost to company, that employer's contribution, that's your money. It's still your salary. That it's just they deduct it before you get it. That's the employer's contribution. So if you're looking at it that way, like what percentage of my income should I save? Should I save 10% of my income? That's 10% of cost to company, I would say.
But a lot of people don't know their cost to company. Now they should, but they might not.
In that case, use the second one down. So I wouldn't go for the smallest number. I would go for the biggest number.
Yeah. See, apart from the 27.5% or 350, whichever is smaller, that you can put in a retirement annuity, and then it matters which you use, because that's cost to company. The others, I mean, yes, you should. I agree with you. Use the second. But use any number you want, because at the end of the day, as long as you always use the same one, you've got a data point that's relevant and that you can compare historically.
Yeah. All right. So between her and her employer, 17% of her money goes to an RA, and she wants to know if it counts. So she says, when they ask about after-tax salary, is that cash salary minus tax, but still including my other deductions like pension fund and medical aid?
Yes.
Yes, what?
It is still including. So you include the retirement annuity contribution that you make, and then a medical aid contribution that you make.
Okay.
Yeah,
but that, I think that's what's confusing about this. It's not the medical aid and the UIF and the RA stuff. It's the tax deduction that makes it difficult.
Yes.
That's why I think cost to company is a better metric, because the tax, before your tax is deducted.
Cost to company is the real number, right? That's what you get every year from the person who gives you money and demands your blood. So it is the real number.
Okay. And then she's trying to make sense of fee reporting on an RA that she has. When I spoke...
No, you can't. Next question.
When I spoke to that legal advisor from VeriCred this morning, he's like, look, I don't want to scare you, but you guys need to be careful about calling out companies on stuff. So I'm going to leave out the company name, but you guys know who it is. So she says, in their EIC table, in this pension fund company's EIC table, they have a normal EAC indicating what her annual costs would be if she continues with the policy. But then they say she should use an alternative table if she's considering moving the RA to compare the new provider's costs. So she says, are they trying to make themselves look better, even though they're still horribly expensive? Or why would the second table apply? At the moment, I compare this current fund value plus the ongoing fees against the termination value and the new provider's fee for the remainder of the term. Am I missing the point with this second table? So she sent this to me. First of all, the EACs are absolutely horrific. Literally in the first year, it's 15.8%.
Yeah, that's because an advisor's got a holiday planned.
I mean, it is unreal. You know what's scary about that is... it's not the advisor fee. The advice fee is 0.4% in that case. The fee, where that comes from, is called other.
Okay.
So that's 13.7% for other.
So my budget does not have an other in it.
So then she sent this to me. It says, the table below shows the EAC calculation, assuming that you terminate your existing investment immediately. The EAC table of the alternative product needs to be compared with the information below to determine whether or not the replacement may be in your best interest. So in other words, they've got an EAC table saying, this is what you're actually paying for holding this product. And then they've got this other EAC table saying, actually, this is what you, this is the fee that you should compare with the other fee, and it excludes that other 13.7%.
Oh, but
move it. This is
you're looking at an EAC, just for simplicity's sake, always take the biggest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mariana, this is the answer that Simon has for you today. With your salary, take the biggest. With the EAC, take the biggest. This is what you work with. Mm-hmm.
Go big.
This is horrific, by the way. Horrific. The smallest fee on that EAC thing that she sent me is 3.9%.
Do they have a marketing fee?
No. They have investment management, advice, administration, and other. It is, yeah. I mean,
this, so the others, that'll be, and that's marketing and all sorts of other bogus stuff. And fortunately, our collective, in the US, the collective investment scheme can charge existing unit holders a marketing fee to, in order for them to catch new.
It's really horrific. Go look at the new Outvest product, Mariana, if you have, I think if you have about 400,000 Rand in this product, go look at the Outvest product. If you have less than that, look at 10X or Signia to put your money. All right. Minard has a really good question about whether ETFs benefit from corporate actions. He says, also keep in mind, we're about 3 months behind in our questions, so it might not sound super recent. He says, with the upcoming elections in the US, there's lots of talks about certain technology companies having to be split up, either by Congress or public pressure, and these include Amazon and Facebook, etc. What happens to these companies that are the major constituents in an ETF? If Amazon, which is about 9% of the NASDAQ 100, decides to spin off Amazon Web Services into a different company, what happens to something like the Satrix NASDAQ 100 ETF? Do those new shares simply land up in the constituents immediately, or will it only benefit at the next rebalancing date? Essentially, do ETFs actually benefit from these occurrences?
So I don't know the NASDAQ rules, but I can talk to the JSE rules.
Because we have a very recent example of
so
this.
We got Process and also MultiChoice. So let's use MultiChoice because it was an easier one. So NASPAS spins MultiChoice out. If you were a NASPAS shareholder, one morning you wake up and you're now a NASPAS shareholder and a MultiChoice shareholder. What the JSE does is it immediately puts MultiChoice into all of the indices that NASPAS existed at the same weight that NASPAS was. So in other words, there's no impact because the NASPAS share price will fall by whatever the MultiChoice share trades at. And then 3 days later, it does two things. It first says, well, does MultiChoice belong in the index? You know, maybe it's so NASPAS is in the industrial index, and maybe it looks at MultiChoice and says, you shouldn't be in the industrial index. So it would boot it out. And then it's just a normal booting process. And everyone else sort of corrects through. The other way they also do it is it big enough to stay? So let's keep it simple and look at MultiChoice and NASPAS in the top 40. So MultiChoice automatically goes into the top 40, but now you've got 41 shares. You're only supposed to have 40. So what they did was 3 days later, they checked the weighting and they see, is MultiChoice a top 40 or is it number 41? In the case of MultiChoice, it was number 20 something. So it stays and number 41 gets booted out.
Okay, and just to remind you guys how we know the size of a company in an index, it is the amount of shares in issue times by the share price. That's a market cap weighted index.
Yeah, that's like a simple market 40. Cap weighted, yeah.
So that's how we would know
and,
that.
And NASDAQ and other indices would do similar sort of processes. But the short answer is that the corporate action in of itself, assuming there's no upliftment in the price or something. So if NASPAS and MultiChoice is equal to what NASPAS was before MultiChoice, there will be no impact in the index.
So I'm assuming that probably with the NASDAQ, you know, if there's a spin-off, those companies, I mean, even a spin-off of Amazon Web Services would be a massive company. So it's presumably they would just be included in the in the index. So I think as a shareholder of those shares, you are not, because that's actually what it comes down to. As a shareholder of those shares, you're not losing value by the spin-off.
Correct. Yeah.
Because that's obviously not in the company's best interest. So yeah. It's easier in this case to think about it as an individual share mm-hmm. and how that would work.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Javier makes a great point about transfer costs when selecting a financial product. So my hope is that in the future, what he's talking about would be illegal. So he was finding a new home for him and his wife's money and decided on ETFSA. He says, an important advantage for new investors using ETFSA would be the advisory service, which is something that ETFSA offers, mm-hmm. combined with the no fee on moving products to different providers in the future. In other words, if you take your RA from ETFSA to Outface, for example, they wouldn't charge a penalty fee to do that. He says it allows new investors to grow and to get advice. And if in the future, with what they have learned, they think their money is better off in a different RA product or TFSA, then they can move it at no cost. I think this would help avoiding many rookie errors. Plus, at the beginning, the fees of a smallish portfolio will not have a huge effect on the future. And the one thing that made me happiest is that they will manage the transfer of existing products my wife had in Old Mutual, so we will not have to do any of the admin just for that it's worth.
So three thoughts, because there's 3 points. In terms of no fee for exiting, all half-decent retirement annuity providers have that. So none of them charge. I mean, the ones that are charging are the old scammers.
So this is true for me. I moved 10X from 10X to Outface, and there was no penalty. Yeah.
So you're getting charged on old-school policies. I think they're the pre-2006. I could be mistaken about that. But the exit fees are a scam and probably don't exist. In terms of the company you're moving to handling the paperwork, again, largely par for the course. If they're going to make you handle the paperwork, find another company, unless they're giving you a negative tour and they pay you to have it there. The 1%, he's not wrong, but he is wrong. What he's looking at is that if you've only invested 100 rand and you're paying 1%, it's only $1. And really, what's $1? Yes, but no, because it's still 1%.
So the point he's trying to make is ETFSA offer an advisory service that's included fee.
I think is a value. If you want advice, then that's a value that you can pay for, absolutely.
But what he's saying is basically that fee that you're paying is an education fee, because you can get this advice and you can learn stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it becomes too expensive or when your portfolio becomes too big, you can move it.
Yeah.
But also hopefully over time, ETFSA might drop their fees. You don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there's a fee war going on there. I think we're going to see some fees down. It's going to take some time because they've built business models, and it's not just ETFSA. It's everyone who's more than 0.2%. They've built business models and they need to rejig that business model for a lower fee, because truthfully 10 years ago 1% was an unheard of fee when 10x arrived, and now it's like, really, a whole percent? Like, what do your ex eat for tea? Caviar.
All right, so Chris is wondering how the Ashburton 1200 stacks up against the I don't know if it's One Vest or One Invest global offering.
It's One Invest, but when you speak to them, they call it One Invest, because if they say One Invest, then everyone just it's love your brand.
I think it's because it reads like One Vest, because there's a one and then invest.
So is there no
I? So okay, I'm gonna go for One Vest. You guys can fight with me later.
Okay, but then what happened to the N?
One Vest.
So where did you get the E from?
From the number one.
So where's the N?
It's in there.
You see, colour me
one
confused.
Invest. One Invest. Oh, it is One Invest because of the E. You're right.
Oh.
If you had to write it, One Invest.
I've never won a word game in my life.
Blowing my mind right now. All right. So the One Invest product tracks the MSCI World Index. That's also the same index that Satrix tracks, by the way. It has a total investment charge of 0.5% with a total expense ratio of 0.4%. It's almost identical to the Satrix product, except it pays dividends, while the Satrix MSCI product is a total return ETF.
Mm-hmm.
So just as an aside there from my side, what makes the Satrix product a little bit cheaper You don't only save on the TER, which is 0.35%, because that is a feeder fund, so they can do that pretty easily. But you also save on the cost of reinvesting your dividends.
Yeah.
So there's a, presumably in that, just correct me if I'm wrong here, you wouldn't pay, there wouldn't be a spread there.
Hmm.
So you would save on the spread and on the brokerage.
I would assume that they put it in at NAV, but truthfully, I don't know.
Because there's no market maker.
I know, but they could just pretend to have a market maker.
Because they don't actually buy shares, they just adjust your share price.
No, well, they add units. So they
Units. Yeah, but I mean, they do that by adjusting the price. They don't add a unit.
Well, some of them literally add a unit. But no, there shouldn't be. I mean, there shouldn't be a spread, but I wouldn't.
So in other words, on the Satrix product, you save on the TER and you save on the brokerage because you're not buying those dividends yourself, mm-hmm. and potentially you're saving on the spread, mm-hmm. although that's under correction.
Mm-hmm.
So the OneInvest product differs from the Ashburton 1200 in four important ways that I can see. First of all, the 1200 tracks a different index, which includes emerging market.
Yeah.
Ashburton distributes dividends twice a year. The TER is much higher, and the Ashburton 1200 is not a feeder fund. In other words, they hold all the underlying shares. Satrix buys an ETF abroad.
Yeah.
That's basically what they do.
The Ashburton's come down to 0.59.
Yeah.
That 1200.
Yeah. So Chris wants to know, where can I see where, when, and how much my dividends in Ashburton will be?
So, I mean, they will announce it via Sense, which you got to go and find, but there's that website.
ETF Enthusiast.
Yeah, you see, I can't spell enthusiast, so
yeah.
I don't get to visit it very often.
Oh, no, sorry. It's called etfcentral.co.za.
Ah, well, then why don't I? I mean, technically they issue a Sense. You could go to MoneyWeb or ShareNet and keep an eye out. I think you could probably do an alert and figure out when those ETFs, when those dividends are coming. So
if you go to ETF Central and you go to the ETF filters, there's actually a filter saying dividend paying ETFs. It lists every single ETF that pays a dividend, as well as the months in which they pay a dividend, as well as the last time they paid a dividend.
Ah.
So it's an awesome, awesome, beautiful tool, and we know who made it, and we are very proud.
So I know that Narina was doing a thingamajig, a list of upcoming dividends, because she, but then I can't see it. I can never find it.
Yeah. All right. Olin is wondering if there's benefit to splitting her retirement savings between an RA and a preservation fund. She says, I've resigned, and I'm not sure if I should split my fund 50-50 between RA and a preservation fund. I'm 43 and I'm starting a new job in February. And which fund or which preservation or pension fund is better?
I wouldn't see a difference. I couldn't think of one.
So with a preservation fund, you can't add more. Somebody told me this the other day.
Correct.
So when you put the money in there, that's it. You can't keep contributing to it.
It's preserving an existing pension. Yeah.
I would just put it in an RA, to be honest. Like, just so that
you can...
Nice,
simple RA.
Yeah, because you can continue contributing to it if you mm-hmm. wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to do the same thing, presumably.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Well, yes.
All right. Lawrence, let's do one more. I think we can squeeze one more in. Lawrence is thinking about the sector exposure of his discretionary investments. I love questions like this. Makes me so happy.
I see geeky spreadsheets.
He has a really sweet ride at the moment. So he says, I only discovered your show about a month ago, and I've been binge listening ever since. I'm a scientist with the government. Like, how is that for the most ominous thing?
No, I mean,
I'm a scientist with the government.
So there was a horror book I read set at the South Pole once, and that was the first thing that came into my mind when you said that.
In terms of, like, horror job, scientist with the government is number one, right?
No, probably quite fun, too. Just click your fingers and happens, right? You're a scientist with the guy. He never queues for a table at a restaurant.
It's like, yeah. Let's not tease him anymore lest poison gas shows up at our house. He says, I don't know if you collect scientists and bottles as well or if it's only engineers.
No, definitely not. No, not us.
So it's so funny because we've now got one scientist, we've got a ton of engineers, we've got a ton of doctors. A
couple of architects.
Three pilots that I've counted. Yeah, and a few architects as well.
The pilots bother me.
Why?
They should be flying.
Yeah.
Like looking out the window and paying attention for stuff at 40,000 feet. I don't know what's up there because I'm always asleep, but like, you know.
He says, I have a great pension plan, and 100% of my expenses will be covered once I retire. It's perks what's of his working question? For the government, right?
I don't understand how he has says, a question. He wants to know what bubbles we like.
He says, my other investments are just bubbles money. So we're coming to Lawrence's house when he retires for bubbles. Thank you. He says, currently 85% of my discretionary investments are in an RA with returns due to me paying for old mutual Christmas party every year. I'm in the process of fixing this. The other 15% is in the MSCI World ETF. He doesn't say which one. I created a spreadsheet with sector distribution for each and then calculated the total percentage for each one. I want to have at least 15% in technology, 10% in industrials, and 15% in real estate. This is a personal preference only and not based on anything. I love that. Yeah, it's not based on anything.
Truthfully, most asset allocations are exactly that. Yeah. They will tell you different, but...
It's not based on anything.
No.
He says, to do this, I've calculated that I need to invest in the following. 31.5% in an industrial fund like the Signia Itrix Fourth Industrial Revolution Global Fund.
Mm-hmm.
8.5% in a real estate investment trust. This will leave me with 8.7% in MSCI World, 51% in an RA, 31.5% in an industrial fund, and 8.7% overall in a real estate investment trust. What do you think of this kind of approach? Does it make sense or am I going to overexpose myself? I would not in a million years put 31% in the Fourth Industrial Revolution ETF. I will not do it. I definitely would not. 100% no to that.
So aside from Christia's phobias, which hate and don't ever knock somebody's phobias, the logic is 100% sound. I mean, we can debate the quantums and the numbers he wants and the percentages and all of that. And I honestly say, you know, so everyone will tell you that asset allocation is the most important component of investing, and they'll always tell you what asset allocation you should have had for years gone by. And when you ask them for years gone forward, they pop out for a smoke break and never come back. Sorry, that's a cat. So pick your numbers, they don't sound crazy, and then your logic is perfectly sound. No, but forget the Fourth Industrial. Step back before that, the numbers that he was referring to and the like.
My eyes nearly popped out of my head just now.
And it all rocks and rolls. I agree, the Fourth so go have a look at that Fourth Industrial, the components. I mean, at one point the biggest holding was GoPro, which I mean, it no longer is because GoPro like fell out of the sky, as it always was going to do.
Well, they were designed to do that.
Yeah, but they should have. They were just, yeah. I mean, then for a while, the big ones were weapons manufacturers. And, you know, there's Satrix NASDAQ, which is a much cleaner tech, maybe less edgy, but, I mean, your call. And then logic is sound, and then decide on your rebalance frequency, monthly, quarterly, annually. The first two are stupid. Do it annually. Do it every 3 years. Because different sectors will run, so you've got to rebalance back to your core asset allocation.
I'm going to have to disagree with you. I don't think so at all. First of all, your MSCI World already has a lot of industrials and tech in it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you add, in addition to your MSCI World, another 30% industrials and tech, you're going to be overexposed. I would not do that. Basically,
what was the... Surely he's looked through MSCI World and seen the tech in that.
Yeah, I think so. But I just... You don't want to be so heavily exposed to a sub-index because when the era of tech and industrials go, your portfolio is going to take a massive knock. I think 31% in any one industry is too much.
But you probably have that.
Yeah, I know because I'm in a market cap weighted. But the thing is, when that changes, the index fixes that for me. I don't need to be involved in that process.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the MSCI. They're not giving me... They're giving me geography breakdown, but they're not giving me sector breakdown, but your biggies, so your top stocks are Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, JP Morgan, Alphabet, J&J, Nestle, and Visa. No, but I'm saying that in your Satrix 40, you're probably quite heavily weighted at certain times into certain sectors as they've moved.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that is a... My cat is attacking Simon because he's talking nonsense. No, so what I'm saying is in a market cap weighted ETF, when the era of industrials and tech dies, the market, the ETF automatically washes that out for me and brings up the next era. When you are invested like this, in this way, in a sub index that gives you exposure to one certain sector, when that sector dies, that's going to be hard for you. It's not going to auto-correct.
No, I that's not wrong. But neither is the concept of how to manage it. I mean, we believe in buy one and set it free. But the man's talking about bubbles, man.
You're just like trying to get into his good books to prevent the poison gas.
Because if this goes well, if he buys the fourth industrial revolution and they buy a spaceship that blows up Mars by mistake and they make lots of money, well, I don't know how that story worked, but just go with me here.
All right, sure.
Could buy Veuve Clicquot. Like all of it. I don't mean a bottle. I mean the estate.
Oh, that'll be nice. Take us, Lawrence. I'm sorry I said that. Talk smack about your idea.
We're free every weekend you invite us.
All right. That's it from the Fat Wallet team this week and Rosie, who's hyperactive today. Please know that this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelap.com. You can also join the Fat Wallet community group on Facebook and meet us in real life on Thursday evening at the JSE. Thank you to Aiden and Kay for being our community wizards. My name is Chris Effendieden. Thank you to Simon Brown. We'll see you on Thursday.